I call this meeting of the House Property Taxes and Local Government Finance Committee to order. Members, as you're coming in, we're going to actually get started. Today we are going to be looking at assessing practices in Minnesota and trying to do kind of an overview of where we are right now and what we have. And then I know there's people here, some who are on the agenda, many maybe who are not, who would like to talk about their pieces and experience relating to assessing practices. But we're going to lay the groundwork. We have today with us the folks from the Minnesota Department of Revenue that lead the activities within the department around assessment. And with us, she's not going to speak today, but the new division director, Cindy Rowley. Ms. Rowley, thank you for being here, and look forward to working with you continuing throughout this session and next. Also, members, we have with us Mr. Klockzien and Ms. Radizovich. Anyway, they'll fix my faux pas, and if you would both proceed. Thank you for giving us a short overview today. And members, their presentation should be in your packet as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Zora Radosovich with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Klockzien. I'm the Assistant Director with the Property Tax Division.
Thank you both. Please proceed.
Okay, last week we provided a broad overview of the functions of the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division, and this week we're going to focus a little bit on the topic of assessment and what the role is for assessors in the department. Successful property tax within Minnesota is a collaboration and cooperation between assessors, the Department of Revenue, auditors, and treasurers. This is to ensure that everyone pays their fair share, no more, no less. While we have different roles, our goals are the same: to have uniformity, transparency, equalization, and accountability. Assessors, among the many things that they do, their main task is to value and classify property according to market value and use using market data. Our role at the Department of Revenue is oversight in the process, making sure that the procedures used in valuing and classifying property adhere to statutory guidelines. Part of that oversight is gathering reports containing assessment data and real estate transactions from assessors that we use to evaluate the uniformity and quality of assessments. Some of the things that we use that sale and market data for are sales ratio studies, determining agricultural market values for state programs, and research reports and revenue estimates that I'm sure you've all seen. In regard to sale data, in order to be useful, the data must be clean as possible, and that means data comes from open market, arm's length transactions. Assessors must value property at market value. Inherent within that definition is that the buyer and seller are typically motivated, both parties are well informed and well advised and acting in their own best interests, a reasonable time is allowed for exposure to the market, payment is made in cash or its equivalent, and there is no unusual financing, and financing is readily available.
The sales ratio study compares...
Ms. Radosevich, thank you.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
Committee. I'll continue. The sales ratio study compares assessed values to the sale price. And we conduct the sales ratio study annually in order to ensure compliance with property tax laws, to evaluate the accuracy and the uniformity of assessments so that similar properties pay a similar share of the taxes, and to equalize values for state aid and other purposes. We want to look to see if there are inequities in the assessment, so that aid programs that are based on valuation and jurisdiction's property wealth have that wealth accurately reflected in the aid calculations. In conducting our sales ratio studies, Minnesota Statutes 270.12 requires us to follow International Association of Assessing Officers standards wherever practical. So So the study measures the relationship between assessor's values and the sale prices. And we do that to determine how close the sales are to the market value on an overall basis, how close individual appraisals are to the median ratio and to each other, and to determine whether the assessor is responding appropriately to changes in the market. We perform a variety of tests and statistical measures to determine these factors and to see how close values are to the assessed value. One of the questions that we need to address is what sales sets that do we use in conducting our sales ratio study. And we look at the sales sets that we use are property type. So we look at vacant land, homes, businesses. We separate commercial and industrial, farmland. We look at it by size as well. So if they're agriculture in particular is below or above 34.5 acres. We look at whether it's tillable or non-tillable land, woods, and then we conduct our study by jurisdiction, and then by county and by region. And we also look at a variety of subsets of the sales data. So within a property type, we'll look at things like residential, is it on water, is it off water? And we're also working to have uniform standards for the definitions that we use for those subsets so that we can get better data. So we heard last week about our electronic certificate of value program and PRISM, which is our, we're moving into implementing, which will allow us to collect parcel-specific data from the counties. And we're developing standard definitions so that we can also analyze by clearer subsets like tilled land. Okay, what the other question that we get asked is what is not automatically included in that study? And things that aren't automatically included are things like sales between relatives, foreclosures, sales with government or nonprofit entities, forced sales, and some of the changes, properties that changed in use or had improvements after the assessment date. So we're largely following International Association of Assessing Officer standards and deciding what goes in and what comes out. These are pretty universal standards across the field of assessment. They aren't unique to Minnesota. Because the whole point, as John mentioned earlier, is to keep in the study those sales that really truly reflect open market arm's length sales that will help the assessor set market values that truly reflect the market.
Ms. Radosevich, could you just kind of expound on that a little bit? I know we talked a little bit yesterday, the day before, about that international standard. And then Representative Erickson, I know, has a question too. But can you just briefly review that and how that ties into these items on the list that you just went through?
So the International Association of Assessment Officers has a standard that we're required to follow to the extent possible. And a large part of their goal is making sure that these sales are open market and arm's length sales. And so there's a list of sales that are generally typically not included. We flag those sales. Some of them do not get included. And then others we have reviewed by the county assessor and our property tax compliance officers to determine whether they might meet that definition and then can be included in the sale.
Thank you, Mr. Radosevich. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, and especially you, Ms. Radosevich.
Radosevich, Ms.
Radosevich, thank you. You said moments ago that you're working to have uniform standards, and then you said we're developing, but that makes me think that you're not yet at that stage. Is that correct? So would we still have inconsistency?
Ms. Radosevich.
Mr. Chair, Representative. No, we have consistency for those studies that we actually use to evaluate assessors. What we're trying to do is move toward being able to look more closely at different subsets. So one of the things with agricultural land, our 2A, 2B land can be divided by tillable, woods, pasture, meadow, and those definitions aren't common across the assessing practice, and so we're developing those. But we are only starting to collect that information. We are not using that to assess their work yet. It's something that when we move into PRISM, which will allow us to collect parcel-specific data, that we will be assigning or asking the assessors to note what those subsets would be.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would that account for some of the variability in land values that we're seeing in rural Minnesota, that the fact that we're not quite there yet?
Ms. Rozovich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, no, that would be a different matter. That would be something at the local level that they're making that determination.
Thank you. That's all I needed to know. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The sales ratio is a number used a lot by assessors, and you say it's the ratio between the assessed value and sale price. How do you come up with the original assessed value, and wouldn't that in itself be based on sale prices? So how do you separate those two when you come up with those original market values?
Ms. Rozovich.
Mr. Chair, Representative. We do a preliminary study that uses the previous year's value, and we compare sales within that time period back to, in this case, the 2014 assessed value. And then assessors take that information along with other information that John will talk a little bit more about and determine values for their next year, so 2015. And then our final study, which will happen in May and June, will reflect back to the new values. So it is a constant process of improving, and it looks back 1 year and compares values and then moves forward.
Representative Anderson.
So when the assessor says he has to be at 90% of the sales ratio, what exactly does that mean?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Ms. Rozovich.
I'd say because assessment isn't an exact science, we give a range of 90 to 105% that their median ratio can fall within. And so they have to get within, and that's a standard that is applied, and it's one of the recommendations from the International Association as well. So you give a range, they need to fall within that, and John is going to talk a little bit about the corrective action.
Yeah. Mr. Klockstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So we array all the sales within a jurisdiction, and then we pick the median as indicative of the level of assessment within that jurisdiction. And so when we say the assessor has to meet 90 to 105%, that median must fall within that. That's our measure to judge the quality of the assessment.
Representative Anderson.
Just one more quick question, thank you. So if he doesn't reach that 90%, he has to raise all of his values to get into that range, is that correct?
Mr. Klogzin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, ideally we would work with the assessor to stratify his sales and find out the commonalities within that subset of sales where his ratios are low and where his ratios are okay, and develop a means to identify which characteristics within the assessment need adjustment and which ones are okay. So that when he moves the sales and then he does the same treatment to other properties that haven't sold, he meets that compliance, but that he does it in a targeted manner.
Thank you, Mr. Klockstein. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure which testifier. You said that the one of the assumptions is that financing is readily available and also that they're cash transactions. What type of adjustments then do you make when a market crashes like we had in 07, 08 where the financing isn't available and obviously then the cash isn't available because if you use those two assumptions, it's going to affect the market value?
Mr. Klockstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative, while we certainly did see financing tighten up during that period, you know, Freddie and Fannie were still doing their work and there still was financing available, and those conditions that resulted in restriction were across the entire market. So that effect was felt over the entire market. You know, if we would have financing only available to, you know, a subset or only available in a certain area, I could see that as being problematic.
Representative Vogel.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. The issue, of course, was that it was really a cliff, not a gradual downturn, and therefore when we're assessing property, looking at the values, especially when you're a year out from where you're going to use that value, is there a mechanism in place that takes into account those rapid changes that are maybe extraordinary but do tend to misvalue probably the property because it's not reacting to the market forces?
Mr. Klogzin.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, the sales study period happens over a year, and we recognize that there can be sudden movements within that year period, and so it's a picture of what happened, and sometimes these sudden swings cannot be accounted for fully or accurately within that year period, but on a whole, we can say this is where the market is.
Just one more follow-up, Mr.
Representative Vogel.
So has there been any consideration given to maybe adjusting those factors since we had what hopefully isn't an anomaly but could happen again in different marketplaces?
Mr. Kloxine. Or Ms. Radozovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. So one of the things that we do, there, we do have an appeal process when we set some of the trends that or the adjustments that should go forward, and we look at that data. If the county says this is really what's happening, we'll look at that and see, and that would mitigate what we would ask them to do.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First to Representative Anderson. About 5-6 years ago, I think the department came into Minneapolis and identified two areas of town where they felt that the valuations were below market value and required the city to increase the valuations on those properties, and made for some fairly unhappy constituents in that area, since I think everyone thinks that in an upmarket, everyone thinks that the assessor is undervaluing their property, and in a downmarket, they think they're overvaluing their property. Here was, you know, a standard against which it was compared, and they found they were actually undervalued, and they weren't happy. But to Ms. Radosevich, at Saturday's hearing in Albert Lea, a not uncommon concern was raised that ag land valuations were not accurate because of the lack of sufficient data to determine comparable properties, and that farmland is unique in that it tends to stay in families for long periods of time. We celebrate century farms, and therefore when a parcel goes up for sale, it's infrequent. And the argument was also made, it's overbid because it may be decades before that parcel comes up again, and if that's the one I want, I'm willing to overpay perhaps for that parcel of land, distorting then the valuation of neighboring parcels because A, sales are infrequent, and B, I've overpaid. I was looking at you, but he seems primed up. Can either of you comment on the concerns about the valuation of ag land on frequency and of sale in particular?
Mr. Kloxine.
Mr. Chair, Representative. As we talked about earlier, we've got a set of criteria to look at to say whether something, a transaction, is a market transaction. And when we look at that, and if it meets certain things that would exclude it from consideration, saying this is really not what the market would command, then we would not place any weight on that sale and move on to the other sales that we feel are representative of the market. Now, I know that ag land is a, you know, land is a commodity that they don't make any more of. And so scarcity and all those things associated with economic principles come into play when a property does come up for sale.
Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just put a finer point on it. Are there enough transactions of farmland to allow you to allow assessors to accurately determine the value of farmland? Or is that a problem in your model?
Mr. Kloxine.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our sales ratio studies uses a minimum of 6 sales to get a picture of what that jurisdiction's market may be. And while assessors would always like to have more sales, there is a certain minimum that we can make judgments about the assessment to say this is representative of the whole.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm trying to understand the granularity of the parameters that you input into your calculations. So would you, when I'm looking at housing and I have young children, One side of the street might be worth a lot more than the other side of the street because my young children won't have to cross a busy street. Those are very localized effects, but can be not, you know, trivial in the value. Does that detail go into when you make your adjustments, Mr. Chair?
Ms. Radosevich?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative. We are part of a mass appraisal process, so we wouldn't specifically look at that level, but it is a factor because we're looking at ratios. So if the property is valued there and it's selling there, the ratio will be similar to if a lower value across the street but is selling for a lower value. So we're looking at the ratios and we want them to accurately reflect what that market is. So people locally will pay more, then those properties should be assessed at what people would pay for them.
Mr. Kloxine, you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's incumbent upon the assessor to take all those factors into consideration when he places his market value.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in ag land, when you're driving, you know, down the township road, you see that there's a lot of variability where there's grassy land, you know, you got grassy runs where there's wetlands, you've got sandy soil next to really, you know, good soil, and, you know, a lot of times it's hit and miss where you've got rocks. So two neighboring farms, how do you take any data, yield, you know, other data, productivity, to be able to, you know, they're right next to each other, to be able to differentiate when you do the assess or you do your ratio calculations?
Ms. Radosevich.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so we would do both. We would do, the basis is the sales ratio study, but as part of that appeal process I mentioned earlier, we also would look at things like crop productivity and other factors. But that, I think, comes back to the point that Mr. Claxton was making, that the local assessor would know that and would be valuing it. So we'll look at a percentage tillable. We might consider productivity and those factors when we're trying to assess whether they fit. But that is something that would happen at the local level. They would make that determination.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then can you enlighten me in what factors would cause a local assessor to take half a field and raise its value 6% and take the other half of the field and raise its value 18% if there's no productivity difference in that field?
Mr. Kloxine, Ms. Radosevich?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, without knowing the specifics of that situation, I'm not sure I could comment as to what value decisions the assessor made.
And Mr. Kloxine, Representative Quam, we're going to hear from some assessors here later, too, so we can maybe ask those questions at that point. I think this is an area of inquiry, as you and Representative Dabney have pointed out, that we've heard a lot about in the whole area of ag land assessing. So if we can move on and hang on to those, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just to comment on that, what Representative Quam mentioned, at least on my farm, there are different classes of land. There's A, B, and C land based on soils maps and, in effect, productivity. And then there's also wasteland, pasture land, woodland, so there are different classifications. But my question, yeah, we hear a lot from farmers about the price of land being driven up by speculation, by outside investors, by out-of-state operations and such. So do you look at those types of sales differently than a neighbor buying a piece of ground from a neighbor? Or, again, is there any way to differentiate what some may term a speculative sale?
Ms. Radosevich.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So one of the things that we do flag are extreme ratios. So if something is sold for an extremely different price than it's assessed, that is something that we would flag, and then the local assessor and our property tax compliant officers would look more deeply into that sale and do some verification.
To that point, Ms. Radosevich, the 1031 exchanges, are those tracked at all in any of these acquisitions or not? Mr. Kloxine.
Mr. Chair, we do track them, and we evaluate them on a case-by-case basis.
So, Mr. Klogstein, are there adjustments made for those, or are those ever thrown out because they are speculative or potentially speculative?
Right, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Klogstein.
We want to have a good picture of the market, a complete picture of the market as possible. And, again, using our criteria that we've developed, we can decide whether this fits within that overall market or not.
Thank you, Mr. Klogstein. Representative Hertaus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on 1031 exchanges. Those buyers are generally considered to be aggressive buyers because they have time constraints in which they must fulfill, and they're basically exchanging like-kind property and have a set proceed in which they need to park. So those are the types of considerations an assessor looks at. They generally pay more for market or a little bit more for property because they're motivated by tax law and tax constraints.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus. I think members and Mr. Klogstein and Ms. Radosevich were ready to proceed again.
Sure. Thank you.
Ms. Radosevich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I was saying earlier, we just finished our preliminary study, which is based on values from last year, and now assessors are in the process of setting values for 2015, and we will then do a study using 2015 values, and that's the study that's used for the State Board of Equalization. So John's going to talk about the State Board.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Klogstein.
So after the sales ratio studies are completed, the Commissioner of Revenue, acting as the State Board of Equalization, is charged with equalizing assessments across the state. The data and analysis section will produce the sales ratio for each jurisdiction by property type. The main measure of assessment, as we talked about earlier, is the median sale ratio, and that is 90 to 105%. When the sales ratio is out of compliance, the State Board of Equalization has the power to order an increase in value for that jurisdiction, a decrease in value, or a reassessment, although that third one is rarely, if ever, used. Ideally, we want to work with the assessors to make sure that we don't have State Board of Equalization orders and that all assessments are in compliance. Equalization is also used for state aids, and as you can see in this simple example, City B assessed value is lower than City A or C. Equalization based on sales ratios gives us a more realistic picture of value used to determine that. In order to do all this good work for Minnesota taxpayers, assessors need to be licensed. All licensed assessors must become accredited by 2019 or within 4 years of becoming licensed, whichever is later. We supported the legislature's decision to enact this requirement. The State Board of Assessors is the licensing body for Minnesota assessors. All county assessors must have the SAMA level of license. If I can go back a second. There are four types of assessor licensing within the state, and the senior accredited Minnesota assessor is the highest level. So all county assessors must have that SAMA level of license, and the Department of Revenue's property tax compliance officers also must have the SAMA level of licensure.
Mr. Klogstein, just quickly, if you would, how much training goes into each of those levels, if you just briefly?
Right. The State Board of Assessors, Mr. Chair, sets the requirements to achieve licensure. And for each level, it's determined. But in order to reach the first level of licensure, you must have a year of experience and then take 3-week-long classes, I believe. I don't know the exact requirements off the top of my head, but at least 3-week-long classes. Some of those given by the Department of Revenue, and some of those through electives or the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers.
So, Mr. Kloxine, 3 weeks for each of those then subsequently higher categories, or 3 weeks each year to maintain?
No.
Mr. Kloxine.
Mr. Chair, in order to achieve that level, that would be the requirements for the first level. Obviously, as you go higher in the scale, the requirements are more in-depth and more advanced.
Thank you. Mr. Kloxine?
Mr. Chair, licensure helps meet some of those goals we talked about earlier for property assessment. We spoke about accreditability and accountability. As the profession matures and meets new challenges, licensure requirements help ensure assessors are able to meet those challenges in a uniform, knowledgeable manner.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Radosevich.
So to achieve uniformity, it's so important that in our, the goals that we talked about earlier, it's so important for that assessors approach assessing from kind of the same basic principles and practices. And to that end, we provide a lot of education to the assessing community, both to help new assessors learn the ropes and learn what they need to go forward, and to help more experienced assessors stay on top of current trends and changing practices, and also to be able to use new tools that are available. And we work very closely with the MAAO, Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, to develop a tool that assessors can use to help replicate some of the studies that we will be doing, so that they aren't surprised by our results, but we can work with them along the way. And so then at conferences, we've taught classes on how to use that, and we'll go out and teach. So that is basically what we do.
Thank you, Ms. Radosevich and Mr. Kloxine. We have a question from Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifiers. It seems to me that what we're all trying to do here is figure out the current value of the property that's being appraised. Private industry, of course, is seeking the same thing and would have an appraisal. What I'm wondering is, it seems to me that maybe some of the state guidelines, the state parameters, may be a different than those appraisers are using. And private industry, of course, is really concerned, because if a bank is going to make a loan on a property, they want to know what it's worth in today's marketplace today. I'm wondering how the training, the guidelines, the things that you're teaching assessors relate to appraisers. In other words, there are certain state guidelines that are being used, the things that you just went over. With the changing market conditions, are you adjusting those guidelines and that training so that they kind of parallel what appraisers are doing, or would it be more of a system where the state has kind of this regimented thing that we've followed for many years, and maybe the appraisal community has moved in somewhat different directions?
Mr. Kloxine.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you had a little bit of two points within that question. The first one was, do assessors do anything different than fee appraisers may? Now, mass appraisal is a little bit different because you're placing a value on all the properties within the jurisdiction and not just looking at one property. So there's time constraints inherent within that. But the assessors will use the same appraisal principles that a fee appraiser will use, and they'll consider the cost, income, and sales market approach to value to ultimately arrive at market value, which should be very similar to a fee appraiser, assuming that they're looking at the same thing. The scope of the appraisal is the same. As far as the requirements for appraisers and assessor, I know that the Department of Commerce has over time increased their requirements that fee appraisers need to meet. And the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers and the State Board of Assessors and the Department of Revenue have all done a good job of increasing our training and increasing what assessors will know and can know.
Representative Vogel.
Chair, follow up. Just first. But it seems to me that the assessors are excluding from their analysis things like, as I mentioned before, the financial resources available for financing and so forth, as well as foreclosures. those are real market forces that are sometimes, as we talked about this cliff of property values, have to be taken into account because things are changing rapidly. So that's what I was most curious about, is how do we make sure that we're really ascertaining the value of that property right now, currently, rather than maybe relying on some historic means that might have been more relevant when the economy was more stable?
Mr. Clarkson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, by statute, the assessment date is January 2nd, and the assessors will place their value as of that particular date, using data that they've gathered over a year period from October 1st to September 30th of the previous year. Fee appraisers have a little bit more freedom, and they will place their market value as of the date of appraisal, whatever that may be. And so there are things that they can take into account that the assessor either does not have knowledge of or is outside of his consideration.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to maybe what I think is the heart of Representative Vogel's question with regard to financing and the immediacy of the sale, there's always been this kind of dichotomy between what's the market value and what's the assessed value, and most people that open their property tax statements either have an opinion one way or the other, whether it's too high or too low or whether it's current with the market. But we need to remind ourselves that the assessed value on that January 2nd is due and payable the following year, so it's always a full year behind. And so the market can be rather resilient in terms of a changing economy, and all things are local, including real estate. So, you know, you may get quite a separation between the assessed value and what the property is really worth today, which I think was the essence of your question.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus. Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. We've heard a lot from some of our local township assessors and licensures. What level of these four would they need to attain to remain in the business?
Mr. Clarkson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, by July 1st, 2019, if they are currently licensed, they will need to be accredited Minnesota assessors, unless they were hired, you know, within that four-year period that would end after 2019, then they would need to achieve that accredited Minnesota assessor license level by that date.
And I think there are one or more bills that may be coming on that topic, Representative Anderson and Mr. Clarkson. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The sales ratio to the testifiers, that varies, does it not, from county to county and, well, what other jurisdictions, school district to school district? So does that account for the variation in equalizing state aid?
Ms. Radosevich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, we actually calculate the sales ratio on those various jurisdictions, and so we can take it into account. And we, as part of the education aids program, we do it by school district, mm-hmm. and then take into account the portion that was within, like with the district across the counties, that it's the ratio from the county where that portion is. So it is localized to the extent of a jurisdictional level.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I know when I represented Benton County, we had a bill in education to try to change the sales ratio for some of that aid. We were not successful, but now I understand why it's getting complicated. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Ms. Radosevich and Mr. Clarkson. And you will be here for a reference if we have questions, and come up and help bail us out on some things as we go through.
Thank you.
Members, let's take a look at the minutes if we could. The chair would entertain a motion to approve the January 21st minutes. Representative McDonald moves approval of the January 21st minutes. Members, any additions or corrections? Seeing none, the are all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion passes. The January 21st, 2015 minutes are approved. The January 22nd minutes, is there a motion?
So moved.
So moved.
Representative Anderson moves that the January 22nd minutes be approved as presented. Any additions, corrections? Anybody see anything? Oh, I was responding to Representative Anderson's hand up, so Representative...
Mr. McDonough. Chair?
Representative Hertaus.
Point of order, I think you'd have to be there to approve the minutes.
Yes, I would agree.
Okay, well, we will amend the motion and provide that Representative Hertaus move those minutes. Any other additions or corrections? Representative Hertaus was in attendance. Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion passes. Those minutes are adopted. And January 24th minutes, so Representative Dabney or Hertaus?
It's just down to the two of us, isn't
it? It is.
It is.
Mr. Chair, can I take a walk on this?
Representative Dabney moves to January 24th minutes. Any additions or corrections, Representative Dabney or Representative Hertaus? Seeing none, members, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion passes. Those minutes are also approved. Thank you, members. We are going to move members into discussion. We do have a couple of assessors here. We're going to have them maybe hold off just for a little bit. I want to hear from some of the people from the public who have come to talk to us today. We have some of them on the list here and then others are not, but all are certainly invited to come up. If you could come up and share your concern topics or ideas with us today and try to be brief because I think there's going to be quite a bit. And we'll start with Mr. Ristinen. Is he?
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thanks for coming, Mr. Ristinen. If you would introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
I'm Lester Ristinen from Wolf Lake Township, Bicker County, Minnesota, and I have been a member of the Bicker County Taxpayer Association for something like 22 years, and I've been chair the last 10-15, and I guess I have to refute some of the testimony I've heard today from personal experience, and I do have documented instances that are in my position and in a filing cabinet. And if anyone wants to really get serious, I can do that.
Mr. Ristin, since you're getting serious, if you would move that mic a little bit closer, we're going to hear your seriousness.
Okay. How's that?
Please proceed, Mr. Ristin. Thank you.
Let me start out. It's going to take about 10 minutes. I hope you're going to give me that time. As an IRS retiree, I have a... Oh, I'm sorry.
We are really going to hear you now, Mr. Ristin.
I'm from the bush, I guess. Okay. As an IRS retiree, I've testified several times before the House and Senate as a member of the Minnesota Senior Federation. So I'm going back a long time. And I can explain why Minnesota ranks 28th in the nation by the Tax Foundation. And I hope you folks aren't proud of that, because you shouldn't be. And I can explain why it is ranked 38th. After moving to our present retirement home, we were immediately harassed by the local assessor. Apparently, according to him, we could afford to pay just about anything on property tax. And the same assessor publicly referred to me as the IRS devil. Apparently, somebody from the IRS must have audited him, and the circumstances must not have come out very well. Well, that was 24 years ago. Then followed by attempting to get help and told by a Department of Revenue employee by calling him down here in St. Paul, I was told that I was being taught a lesson. That was strange to me. And then the same fellow actually hung up on me, and I became an activist, and I'm still an activist. It was also impossible to get answers about the system, so I became a contract assessor, because it was obviously the only way to learn the system. The first thing I learned was that my predecessor, and I followed him in two townships, was that he logged 125 field calls in one day in two townships that were 31 miles apart. Not only that, but I also found out that some of the folks he hadn't visited for 15 years. And I also found out that he was assessing buildings, believe it or not, that did not even exist. And there's a reason for that, too. He was balancing out the value of the township, I presume. What taxpayers are dealing with is overwhelming politics, because that's what it's all about. It really isn't market value, it's politics. And from the township level right on up to the Department of Property Tax Division. Minnesota Property Tax Administration does not, on law, but on innuendo, to con and intimidate taxpayers. And we've got all kinds of testimony and people that have, and not just in Becker County. This goes all the way to, you can go to Blue Earth or wherever. This is what happens. Washington County, too. As a newcomer in the township, I was actually told by a county deputy assessor to accept the assessment that I was appealing, or they would add Lakeshore to the assessment. We have 300 feet of junk Lakeshore. And my reply was, and I was upset, I said, told them to assess every last thing on our property right there and then, and nobody was going to pull this kind of stuff to intimidate me or threaten me. And so that's supposedly what happened. But the harassment continued. It just stopped when we got a new assessor here about 2-3 years ago in the township. Because assessors are not held accountable, the system is prone to cronyism and corruption that has been documented and then even actually reported in the Minneapolis Star and Tribune. You'll recall that back in 2000-2001, I found out as an assessor that many assessors did not assess Lakeshore in different lakes. And so we brought this up to the Department of Revenue, and after some haranguing over that, and the Minneapolis Tribune article, believe it or not, there was an investigation conducted, and the county auditor tells me that the property values in Becker County rose $3 million right then and there. So property, I keep hearing this, that market value, if it's within 90 to 115% is acceptable to the International Association of Assessing Officers. But this isn't realistic. It can't be realistically acceptable if the assessor isn't honest in evaluating property. And here's where the problem comes. Who's proving that these assessors are really doing the job that they're paid to do? Their drive-bys and their omissions. I've had a township assessor, a township supervisor in Spruce Grove Township tell me when they finally fired this assessor that he hadn't been to his home in 15 years. And I also have a lady friend that goes to our church who hasn't seen an assessor only twice in the 50 years they've lived on the place. So you can't tell me that the assessors are really doing a job there. And this actually couples with the equalization boards. They're made up of people who are hired by the assessors. And then when you get, they hire the assessor. That's what I'm trying to say. This is a conflict of interest. To go to even a township or even to the county level where the county board of commissioners is the board of review. You go to other states, Michigan, for instance, the township appoints their board of equalization. There are no assessors on that board, and I can see why they do that. Texas is the same way. In Indiana, you can go and cover all many, many states, and I've researched them in detail, and believe it or not, the IRS did teach me how to research, so I have some. I feel that I'm fully capable of doing that. So with the present system we have in the equalization board, it's like the fox guarding the hen house. We got to get these politics, the petty politics and the not-so-petty politics, they just absolutely have to come out of this system. You can't treat the people, property owners in Minnesota like this. So as I said before, I've got 4 file drawers of taxpayer complaints over 20 years, and not just from our township, but other. When I was with the Minnesota Senior Federation, we conducted seminars on property taxes on different counties, especially south of our area. We were in Douglas County, Grant County, and the like. And we also ran into people where a lady told me she didn't want to stir up the pot that assessor hadn't been at her house for 12 years, so, and she didn't want to aggravate him at all. Anyway, I'm telling you that it's politics, and we can't ignore them. They're in a multitude of issues. We had a taxpayer who had a $350 refund coming when he posted his house for sale, and it was certified appraisal on it. And guess what? The assessor happened to be the brother of the county assessor. And the county assessor wasn't about to give that $350 refund. He did get it, but it did take almost 2 years to get that. The county assessor didn't want to admit that his brother would have made such a drastic mistake of $35,000 in valuation. So that's where we stand. And I have personally taken Representative Runbeck and Senator Hoffman on a tour of four townships here a few years ago, and the townships that had outrageous in assessments, including a logger's overvalued lake home that forced him into bankruptcy. And the poor guy worked day and night, literally, to try and keep up. He was on Wolf Lake, and it basically, the shoreline is nothing but mud, and it was just absolutely overvalued to the point where something should have been done. We can't get the county commissioners to do anything. They have a vested interest in the county assessor, and they don't want to overrule over him. Well, anyway, we saw this property. He was assessed $675 on that property when the assessment should have been more like $4,000 or $5,000. How can this system force people into bankruptcy? And then there was also an old lady that we visited there, or her property, and it was listed as a Rambler. It was over-assessed by almost double. And believe it or not, the so-called Rambler was nothing but two old mobile homes that were bolted together. This is where I'm contesting that these assessment values are just crazy. It all depends on the assessor that's out there and how they're ranked or how they're overseen.
Mr. Risson, if we can wrap it up here, we're over 10 minutes.
You're overcoming, huh?
Yes.
Okay, I want to talk about the Minnesota Constitution, Article 5, Section 1, states that taxation shall be fair and uniform for all classes of subjects. But how can it be if the assessment standards are set by each county assessor? It can't be uniform when the houses are graded differently and all that. Would you please read before I'm cut off, or do I have a few more minutes?
30 seconds, Mr. Rister.
30 seconds. Okay. Please read the handout here. This is a classic example of how...
I believe, members, that handout's coming around.
Oh.
That handout's coming around, Mr. Risson. Oh. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Risson and members?
Yeah. Okay. I'm open.
We don't have any yet, Mr. Risson, and we're working on them. So we'll call you back up as we develop those.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Sounds good.
Next, Mr. David Feld. Is he here? Mr. Feld? And then we'll go with Mr. Frank after that. Welcome, Mr. Felt. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is David Felt, and I'm on the board of Wolf Lake Township Supervisor. And I was here to on the tax problems over there on the reassessment of Wolf Lake. The people got some money back, and... approximately $15,000, they're over excess or something like that. But Becker County says that has ruled against any abatements. So I was just wondering, if he had money coming back, he overpaid, is there a problem for returning the money to the taxpayer?
Is there anybody, the Department of Revenue folks, can you address Mr. Felt's question? Please introduce yourself. This is one of our assessors. Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is John Hagan. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And Mr. Felt raises an interesting question. In Wolf Lake Township was ordered to be reassessed, and they entirely reassessed the entire township. And in the course of that, as you would in any reassessment, they found some properties went up, some properties went down, as you would when you take a whole new look at any assessment. My understanding, based on Mr. Felt's testimony, is that the Becker County Board of Commissioners made the determination that as a result of that reassessment, they would not grant abatements for any properties that went down in value. And of course, that is their right within the statutory authority. The only way refunds could be issued is through the Minnesota statute that authorizes abatements. I think it's 375.192, and that gives the County Board of Commissioners the discretionary authority to grant abatements to a property for the current year, and then in the other two prior years, it's very, very closely restricted. It has to be in the case of a hardship or a clerical error. But the county board had the authority and the discretionary authority to either grant or not grant abatements for that current year tax year, and apparently they chose not to.
So, Mr. Hagan, what happens? Does that landowner then automatically get that deducted from their next property tax, or are they just out of luck? Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, the corrected assessments would go forward into the future tax years, and there would be no, just as the people whose value went up, they would not go back in time and raise those retroactively. The people whose value went down, they would not go back in time. So I guess, as you said, Mr. Chair, they would be out of luck if they had been paying more taxes. And it's, you know, property tax gets a bad name in a lot of respects. And I think a lot of it you could talk about because of the method of payment where you have to come up with the amount every year in two equal chunks. There's a lot of history for it. But the property tax, it's one of the few taxes that a property owner has multiple opportunities to review their value and contest their value. They get a valuation notice every year, and at that time the property owner has the opportunity to come in and challenge your value. They can talk to the assessor. They can go to the local board of appeal and equalization, which Mr. Felt would be part of as the Wolf Lake Township Supervisor. If they're not happy there, they have the opportunity to go to the County Board of Equalization to make their case and try to see if they can get whatever relief they're seeking. And all these are free. They're all available to every property owner in the state. And then if they're still not happy, then they have the opportunity to go to Minnesota Tax Court, and they can go to the Small Claims Division, which does not require attorneys. People can appear pro se, or they can appear on their own behalf, and and the tax court will come out to the county and hear their appeal. So there's a number of appeal opportunities for people. So because of that, we feel that property owners have sort of a shared responsibility in making certain that their property is, in fact, assessed correctly. If it's assessed too much, people should properly come in and challenge the assessment, and they should continue that challenge until they're successful. And if by not challenging it, there's an expectation that they agree with it.
Thank you, Mr. Felt. So Mr. Hagan, did those property owners have the ability to get involved in that local process, or did they find out after all of those opportunities had passed that they had been overassessed, or what happened in that situation? Mr. Felt.
Well, I don't really, I came in on the tail end of that. I was first time as a supervisor, but they were assessed, everything was just already reassessed, and I think we hired another assessor to redo it, and then I don't know, each individual has to go through the process.
That's what Mr. Hagan is outlining for us, Mr. Felt.
I don't know if that was done or not.
Okay. Maybe we can learn more offline. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hagan, just listening to you, you just explained something I guess I never understood, and I just want to think about it a little bit. From we're spending a lot of time right now thinking about, you know, rural assessments, but all of us in the metro, you know, we care profoundly about them as well. And in fact, the 90% to 105% is always, to me, a really critical part of the system, because there have been look-backs in the past that the legislature asked for, and we found that there were whole parts of the state that were undervaluing property, and that made other parts of the state pay more in aid to those areas because they looked, you know, not as wealthy, and so they were getting significant amounts of aid from one part of the state to another, when in fact, after the sales ratio studies show that came in, it showed that these properties were selling at higher values. And I think the fact that we follow those rules is really important. And, you know, Mr. Chair, I don't know if someday you want to ask for the same information, but I remember a previous chair, Chair Abrams, asking for data across the state to show, you know, who across the state is doing a good job and who isn't. And at that time, it was very clear that the metro assessors were doing a pretty good job and a lot of the outstate assessors were not. Now, that was quite a while ago. And I think a lot of the development of professionalism of the industry has helped make us work more off fact-based instead of emotional-based or friendship-based or whatever, and I think that's good. We should expect a professionalized group of people doing this work. But, you know, when I was on our Bloomington City Council, we would have people, I mean, there's a whole group of attorneys who sue cities in the metro who don't assess people's property values correctly. And so we really rely on our assessors to do an incredibly great job, because we pay, we go to court when the Mall of America is assessed wrong, or fill in the blank, you know, $50 million building. And when that property owner goes and sues the city of Bloomington saying, you know, you overassessed us and therefore we're paying way too much in taxes, if they win in court, you know, that local city council is in, you know, has to do what we call abatements. Okay, so those have just been brought up. And, you know, I have never heard, and in fact I was on the Bloomington City Council when the city council was on the losing end on a number of those legal actions, I have never heard that a city council could go to the county board, so I just want to think this through, and say, hey, county board, can you just say that we don't have to pay those people that money back? I mean, am I hearing that correctly? Because the testimony here, I think the testifier is making a good point. I mean, if the assessors did it wrong and their property was overassessed and now it's going to be underassessed, and the testifier is saying, you know, don't I get my refund? The county board can go and say, no, you don't get it? Is that correct?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, the only part I disagree with at all is that the city council wouldn't go on their behalf, but each individual property owner could make application for an abatement. And by statute, the abatements are at the discretion of the county board, and they can either approve them or deny them. For the current year in particular, they can basically, it's not too many requirements for the current year, taxes payable current year. They can approve it or they can not approve it. It is, they do have to consider it, but it is totally at the discretion of the county board.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynch.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, thank you, Mr. Hagan, for educating us on that. I remember years where our city was off in the millions of dollars, and then our taxpayers had to pay for that, those errors. And I think that's why we want professionalism, so that we can get these as close as possible. But, you know, I appreciate learning this, and I think, you know, it's something to think about, how when somebody is in the situation of the testifier, what could we do about that? Could we say that the county commissioners can't deny that right for the person to get a refund? Or, you know, it's just something to think about going forward. I just had never heard that before.
Chair Lincheski, we're the legislature.
So you can pass that bill, Mr. Chair. That's what I'm saying to you.
Thank you, Chair Lincheski. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually just want to follow up on that, just to ask about the flip side, which you referenced before as a testifier, that if the property was determined to have been undervalued, then I guess because I can see definitely the justice in saying if somebody's property was overvalued, they should get an abatement. But it does make me question on the other side, if somebody's property was undervalued, does that county board then, you know, I'm just trying to think that through then. Do we then say that those properties are undervalued, then they have to pay in at that point, which seems a lot more troubling in the same way that abatements. I guess I'm just wondering how on the other side, it says, does the county board have, I guess my question is, does the county board have the same sort of discretion on the flip side could they order a property owner to pay in if their property turned out to have been undervalued? How does that work compared to the other side?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, yes, there is a provision. It's one of the most difficult statutes in all of the statutes to read. It's called the Undervalued and Omitted Property Statute. And I've been reading it for 28 years.
People, Mr. Hagan, the people in rural Minnesota are running scared right now.
It's extremely difficult to read, but there is a provision that if a property was undervalued by reason of its undervaluation or omission, the county board has the authority to go back and look back. And this is where it gets really confusing. From the time it was assessed or should have been assessed, and they go back, I'm not certain if it's 1 or up to 3 years, but no more than that. And then a case of omitted property, and the courts have ruled that omitted property is property that has entirely escaped detection. So that would mean if we missed a house or a garage or a lot, that wouldn't count. If any part of that property was assessed, it would be undervalued property. But for it to be omitted property, it would have to be totally excluded from taxation, so there could be no tax statement. In a case like that, the county board can go back, or the county can go back up to 8 years and require the property owner to pay that amount. This is done extremely rarely. As you might guess, a property being totally excluded from assessment is, I think I've heard of it once in my 28-year career with the department. And although properties are routinely undervalued, I mean, it happens in the case of Wolf Lake Township on a reassessment, it's extremely rare for a county to look back and try to capture that value for a structure that was missed. Usually, you know, they just go forward and make it right going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, follow up on that. It seems like the situation we've been discussing is where there's been a review, a reassessment across all property owners in a jurisdiction, discovering some are under, some are over, and then yeah, there's the situation trying to figure out a mistake has been made that was sort of discovered by the assessing agency, and then what to do about that. Versus, I guess there's a situation that Representative Lencheski is referring to where there's an actual lawsuit brought by an individual property owner. And is there a distinction there in those two situations?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, could you repeat the question, Representative Pinto?
Representative Pinto, if you could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to understand if there's a distinction between a situation where an individual property owner brings suit and the court says you deserve an abatement at that point, versus the it sounds like you're describing a look back that the jurisdiction has ordered, saying, well, we made some mistakes, but I can imagine some justice there saying, well, made some mistakes, and now we're moving forward into the future.
Right. Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I apologize for not understanding the first time. It was a straightforward question. In the case of a court decision, if there's a litigation or a stipulation involved, the courts can order a refund. And on occasions, the county or the taxing jurisdiction will agree to a stipulation or an abatement of the property values to settle a lawsuit. But in a case, it's different in the case of litigation and more compelling, certainly, if the court can order things that the county board or nobody else can order.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hagan. Mr. Hagan, Mr. Lyle, anything else on this topic you'd like to cover?
Mr.
Felt, I'm sorry. Mr.
Well, I guess that was... that was it, sort of. In another case in the township, there was a property that was omitted for 20 years. I don't know if that's the one he's referring to, but
I think that's the type of example he's talking about. We didn't know it was that long, though.
Right.
So one question, Mr. Hagan, maybe you know, or Mr. Felt, maybe you know, in Wolf Lake Township, what was the average amount that would have been sought for abatement by those property owners? I would suspect it's probably not the amount we would have at the Mall of America that would draw attorneys.
It was
Mr.
$15,000 for all property owners.
So each of them, it was $15,000 combined.
No, the $15,000 is
combined
total.
Over how many?
Divvy it up on who got what.
Over how many properties, Mr. Felt?
10.
Okay, so about $1,500 per property on average.
Yeah, I think 10 or 11.
Thank you, Mr. Felton. Thank you, Mr. Hagan.
All right,
good discussion.
Thank you.
Mr. Frank. Please introduce yourself and proceed, Mr. Frank.
Okay, my name is Ron Frank. I'm from the Lisle, Minnesota, and we're in the very southern end of the state. In fact, our farmland borders the state line, so we have perspective on how Iowa values their farmland and some of those things. Also, I've been mayor of our small town for 8 years. I'm not now, but I'm city council. And so I have a lot of perspective on this, and we heard a lot about, you know, why and how, and maybe we should be talking about what. And I did some research just on our own family farm from 2007 to 2014 in our county, which was Maurer County. The property tax at 422 acres was $9,020. The 14 property tax was $16,900. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, school bonding and stuff like that, and that's important, but the effect of the assessment process and evaluation of farmland has really driven a lot of funny things that happen in our county, especially. Of that raise, the county portion of that actually went up 2.7 times. The school only went up 1.45 times in various other jurisdictions. Most of that is due to how farmland is assessed. We've talked about all these things that they use. The fact is that very, very little farmland ever hits the market for various reasons, estate laws, taxing purposes, federal tax law. And it is very detrimental to sell farmland, and there's a lot of family talked about century farms, those kind of things. So out of approximately 150,000 acres in our county, there's probably only 3,000 acres sold on the open market in any 1 year. There's some family transfers and things like that. They're undervalued. They do not use those undervalued things. So now we see a few auctions and things of that nature. Just in the last 5 months, we've had land not that much different value. One sold on auction for $4,600 an acre. We had another one, private sale, $10,000 an acre. We had another one higher. Actually, similar lands, one sold on auction, that should be arm's length transaction. Then we have this other sale. It wasn't a related party sale, and there was three bidders that had been wanting that land for the last 25 years, and we've had some good farm incomes. They're going to spend that money. The point is, that land will never pay for itself. Actually, right now, if you took at rental rates, they'd be in a negative return on that price. We're not using economic values to do this. And it's due to all those other factors that I just iterated. So what happens is the tax base in our county is 54% ag land, and it seems kind of strange. We're home to a Fortune 500 company with a lot of infrastructure. And so between the residential and people, the property tax for homeowners especially have been going down, and you know, the legislature likes to congratulate themselves on lowering property tax for homeowners. They should be thanking us farmers because we've been picking up the tax bill. So what I'm going to propose, and I have neighbors, friends, I worked down on the Iowa side for years. In Iowa, on their ag land class assessing process, they use a income-based approach, which is an accepted approach in assessing and appraisal values. They've talked about that income approach. The fact of the matter, assessors rarely use income approach for valuing property. That's just fact of life. You can do your research. Probably, I don't know who would argue against that. And some of the, so I went and did some research. I talked to the county auditor on the county to the south, and I talked to the assessor, talked to the superintendent and the neighboring school district. They use a productivity base. By Iowa statute, they have to be assessed at 100% of productivity value, which basically what that land will return to the farmer in any 1 year. That is, there's some things that buffer that, the high increases and low increases and things like that nature. But the net result is that land directly across the road, similar type, our average farmland tax, a lot of it is special ag, average is $41 an acre. The average farmland across the road, the per acre tax is $19.51 per acre. 2007, our taxes were $21 an acre, and theirs was probably, theirs hasn't went up that much, so there wasn't that much difference. I will say, go back to some of the effects of that, is the next tax to pass here, debt equalization aid that comes to the school. I did some research on Department of Education sheets on local data, our local school district, and we have a bond issue in a new school that we built in 2006. A lot of controversy, you know, farmers are paying too much and stuff for that. The debt equalization aid is a factor of tax capacity divided by population, and when we started out, our school district is getting $110,000 a year in debt equalization aid. Because of these assessed values and tax capacity, they're getting zero. So that's another $110,000 that the school district has to levy to make up for that. So these are all the unforeseen consequences of a tax policy that's not serving the needs anymore. So a lot of people have talked about trying to get this simplified, and there's plenty of evidence that why we need to do that. I think as farmers, we do like to pay our fair share, and what happens is that when we get these bond issues, and there's school facilities that need to get built, we got old buildings, ours was virtually falling down, and it had to get replaced. There was no other alternative to that. What it does now is that we pit our community farmer against homeowner in town, commercial guy against farmer, against homeowner, and it fractures our communities. And they're small communities, we need each other. And this is the effect of that, the policy, the assessment policy practice is, there's been a lot of testimony, it's pretty arbitrary a lot of times. The state is trying to get that, doing their best so it's not quite as arbitrary, but the statutes and processes itself do make it that way, and we get these unforeseen things. So I got a lot of fact and figures that I kind of listened to the rest of the testimony on that. As a, to put things in perspective, the tax on that farmland has been more than I profited on that farmland the last 2 years. Just put those things in perspective in your mind and see how that rolls around in your head. So
that's at $41 per acre?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Frank. Any questions for Mr. Frank? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Frank, thank you for coming. I've had people contact me, too, about doing assessing in a different manner based on the income approach. So I just have to ask, your familiarity with Iowa, you know, the last 3, 4, 5 years has been good for farming in terms of income and productivity. So did the taxes jump up in Iowa based on the productivity and the high price of commodities in the previous years, and now we're on that downturn? So what about the stability of that tax system in Iowa?
Well,
Mr. Frank.
Okay, thank you. The tax went up some, and they use kind of like a 5-year window, and they also have a statutory 4% cap on any increase, so that buffers that raise. And if it goes down, they have a rollback. They look at that window and see if it meets into the. Right now, the assessed property, as it assessed right now, the one across the road, assessed value is $227,000 on 110 acres. Then they have the rollback to help meet that other standard. It was about 43%, so the actually assessed value is about $99,000. So there's, they have their set of things. So the assessor gets a factor from the state, and the state does those equalization tasks and stuff like our state does, so things kind of match up. But the factor on productivity, so what they do is they get, the current one is like 27, so you take these CSR times acres. In this case, it comes to about $8,200, and they took that times 26. That comes to approximately $226,000. Then they apply the rollback. So that does it's tied to the productivity, so the CSR ratings that all farmland has, and that's getting revised, which probably needs to. So they have that. So your answer is just go up and down. Yeah, but not as fast.
So, Mr. Frank, the CSR, is that like our CERs here?
Correct.
Okay.
It's about the same thing. Then there's some revision going on in that area right now.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, follow-up? Okay, other questions for Mr. Frank. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious if that model in Iowa also applies to commercial, industrial, or homeowner property taxes. And just thinking a little bit, when you have those downtimes in crop prices, commodity prices, where does that tax burden fall onto? Is there state aids or?
Okay. Mr. Frank.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lean. The for commercial property and for homeowners and other property, they use a system similar to the state of Minnesota. The one, the ag land one, is a separate type of assessment. And you read the history of that, was that back in the 70s we had this farmland bubble and those kind of things, and they had some of the same things happen. And so they went to a partial system in 77, and 79 they went to a permanent system that, as I just described. And there's politics in every state and how they do those things. Commercial property tax is a big problem in our state. We go to the next town south, St. Ansgar, Iowa. They're going to be building a new school. The farmland owners and everybody else is going to share. There's no state aid for debt equalization or that kind of thing. But there's also a cap on the assessed value besides on top of that. So that's probably put out. But as far as commercial property, they have a business park down in St. Ansgar, Iowa. They build a building and they have somebody in it almost immediately, and we struggle on the state line to get any kind of business because of business climate. It's a separate issue, but those are some of the things that happen. So, thank you.
Other questions, members? Thank you, Mr. Frank. Thank you for your testimony. Good discussion again. Anyone else who would like to testify, please come forward. We are running short on time, so we're going to have to keep these shorter than the previous ones. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Gary Ehrlich. I live in the city of Scandia, northern Washington County. I'll hit on three different things here. Earlier in the presentation, there was talk about not considering forfeitures as part of the reason for assessment. We've had a number of foreclosures in the neighborhood that I live in, and the properties have resold, and I think it affects the overall value. People are not getting the market value when they're putting their homes up for sale. And in my situation, my land value 2013 to 2014 went up 32%, just the land value. My dwelling value went up 14%. My property is now appraised at a higher value than I can sell it for. I have an appraisal done by a fee appraiser within the last 5 years. And when I called Washington County Assessor's Office, he referred me to Scandia because they have their own assessor. When I talked to that assessor, he said I have to go to district court. I've checked with all my neighbors, and everyone's land value has gone up 31%, or around 30% in 1 year. And we don't have any oil in Scandia, so there's no reason for that. Basically, they're telling us that land values have gone up, so we did some checking. There's been one lot sold on in our neighborhood, and the lot was valued at $103,000 today, That also went up 30% from 2013 to 2014. The lot sold for $90,000 in 2012. So that gives you some idea. So I do not feel that the land value increase is justified based upon what's happening in our neighborhood and in the city of Scandia. If you look at sales, people are not getting their market value that they're having to accept a lower price. And they tell me my only resource now is I go to district court, tax court. So do all the people in our neighborhood have to go to tax court to get something done here? It's my understanding that a judge can make that decision.
Thank you, Mr. Orlich. Orlich. Anyone from revenue want to address that, Mr. Hagan? Yes, Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Hagan of the Department of Revenue. Mr. Orlich makes a very good point. I think it is a little problematic in the area when you have a local assessor, because the local assessor may be working a bit independently of the county assessor, and there's a bit of a disconnect where the local assessor is paid by the local board and the county assessor is paid by a different group, and so they have sort of different masters they're serving. So that's a bit of a problem. But certainly in the case of an overvaluation, or if you think your property is overvalued, you should be able to go to the local Board of Appeal and Equalization, the Scandia Board of Appeal and Equalization, and challenge that value. And hopefully that would be a fair and impartial hearing. And if you're not successful, you should be able to go to the county. And I would certainly think the county should be willing to discuss your value, too, even though it is in Scandia Township. I think if you were to go back and talk to the county assessor and say that you had no inroads or had no success with the local assessor, I think the county assessor certainly should listen to you and look at your concerns and listen to your appeal. And then if you can appeal your value. If you don't get the satisfaction you require or desire at the local board, you can go to the county Board of Appeal and Equalization, and then the county will be there and they'd have to hear your value. And then, of course, you can go to tax court. But a lot of these issues can be resolved by talking to the assessor, the county assessor, and going to the local board, county board, or if need be, go to tax court. But most issues like this can be resolved if they're in fact reasonable issues.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Mr. Orlich.
Yes, one question is, if I go through this process and find that my land is truly overvalued, then why can't that be applied to the rest of the neighborhood or the area rather than each one individually going to tax court?
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, and it could be. If you could establish that your property was overvalued, and assuming all lots were like your lot, if they were all essentially identical, mm-hmm. the county board would have the authority, if you could make the compelling case that your lot was in fact overvalued, but it would have to be current information. You mentioned you had an appraisal that was 5 years old, which a lot has happened in 5 years in the residential real estate market, so that would probably be of little value. But if all the lots were similar or identical, or as identical as lots can be, I think the county board would certainly have the authority, if they felt your lot was overvalued, to make similar reductions on like lots.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. And Mr. Orlich,
one more question.
One parting comment here.
Is there a law that limits how much land can be increased each year?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, there is no such law.
Thank you, Mr. Orlich. Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney. Yes.
Mr. Chair, staying out of whether your land is valued correctly or not, I've never seen it. I have no idea. But last week, you, Mr. Chair, you had on the agenda Representative Carlson's bill that dealt with our targeting program. And we are hearing more stories like this where, presumably correctly, you know, I don't know about your situation, land values are going up, the residential market is coming back, and folks are getting hit with significant spikes in their property taxes. And Representative Carlson is looking to respond to that through our targeting program. It was on the agenda. You didn't hear it. I'm hoping that you will, because that is a way to respond directly to property taxpayers when their property is correctly valued as significantly increasing as the market comes back.
Thank you, Representative Davening. Yes, we will. And I've talked to Representative Carlson about that. And the chair aspires to hear every bill that comes before our committee if we can do it. So, good luck with that. Probably, well, maybe we'll 80%, whatever. So, thank you both, and thank you, Representative Davening. Who would like to, anybody else would like to come up? And Mr. Miller, please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Lynn Miller, and we have a 659-acre farm in Steele County, east of Otana. And we got involved in this process because we started a tax petition. And what we ran into is that our assessor refuses to look at the market value of tillable land. He won't go out, and we had some pronounced differences in that. And that seems to be in violation of 273.12, where it says the assessor will look at every element and evaluate it. But they don't want to get involved because of the mass appraisal. And they were also we were also told they weren't qualified to evaluate farmland. And so that got us down to the problems we're having with our petition, because our land is kind of complicated. We're half tillable and half non-tillable, and some pretty rough-looking stuff. And so in those parcels, we have a lot of sub-parcels, woods, waste, wetlands, et cetera, pastures with different 50 CERs, and we can't get a map of that. Because we have parcels where we don't really have 40 acres of woods, but we're getting assessed at that. And they can't provide that. And they can't provide definitions for those land types. You know, what really is a woods? We don't think it's willows. We think it's hardwood trees and things, and not slough ground. And so those two things have made the preparation for the petition really hard. And like one example is that on our really good land, 80 CERs, we have a 2.5 acre field that was split by the road, and you can't even open a big planter in it and plant it. But the things that I'm kind of seeing is that the better land is closer to right, but it doesn't take into consideration everything a farmer would, like access, tile outlet, soil types, slopes, waterways, county, etc. But where we really start to get hammered is when those soils get poorer. And the reason we get hammered is because of the multiplier they use in a linear equation. And we've gone from a multiplier at 34 for taxes payable 95, that multiplier will be 92.5. So we get automatic increases on land, whether there's any sales data or not. And in Steele County, there's no sales data for pasture land and things, none. And yet we'll see big increases. And an example would be like 13 acres with the really bad slopes, 55 CERs, that carries that kind of pasture land is going to carry values in the 5,500 now with that multiplier, with no sales data. And most rural, I don't know why they call it rural vacant land, that's a sore spot with a lot of people, non-tillable land, we're gonna see valuations of 5,500. And on a lot of good land, we're $1,500 away from good land, and yet this is land that really can't contribute much to anybody's pocketbook. And the increases are automatic, and it comes because of their linear function. And I've checked it out with Neil Harrell, retired Iowa State economist, and Paul Neffler, the farm CPA, and there's nothing in life that has a linear function except property taxes, because at some point, because of the cost of inputs and the return, we go like this. But not in Minnesota. It goes right to the bitter end. And so because of that, rural vacant land is just really getting hit. And the valuations are way out of line. No sales data. And I don't think the system even takes into account the chilling effects of the taxing bone action on this type of land. And most of it is assessed at the 1%. So you're looking at, when you go to get a loan on this, when you see the taxes on some of the poor land, it's a big obstacle. And I think that's all I had. I tried to make it quick.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. And maybe we're going to have some assessors up. Maybe they can address your question. Members, you have any questions for Mr. Miller? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Joe Lorsung. I live up by Detroit Lakes, Becker County. I came down with a group of people yesterday and had quite an education with that. The reason I came down was for a friend of mine who has a property that was valued. I've got some quick notes. I'll try not to bore you with numbers, but I listened to speeches earlier today about 90 to 110% of value, and I don't quite understand how some of this stuff will work or how these numbers come about. I listened to a talk about how the state had looked at the auditing of a county or of a township, Green Valley Township. I remember seeing the numbers when they came out in the papers, and they talked about almost $250,000 going down and more than a quarter, almost $300,000 going up. And when you look at that and you think, well, that was just revaluing different areas of other people's property, what you don't hear is that a lot of that revaluing, the increases, came to people who were almost related, closely related, or some of the relatives of a lot of the auditors, commissioners, and people in that county. And that's the sad part, that you don't hear those little details on. The people whose property went up were those who were either left off. We heard of a house or some property off for 29 years. I heard that mentioned. I heard a 20-year admitted. Others were 15 years. A lot of that stuff gets overlooked, and that's one of the reasons I came here. The particular property that I was talking about is a friend of mine. He bought it back around 2011. It was assessed in 2010. It hadn't been reassessed since, but it's been increased each time. The silliest thing was it was sold to him, or he bought it through an auction at arm's length. It was advertised for a long time, more than the 60 days required for an arm's length transaction. He paid $105,000 for it. The year before, it was assessed at over $200,000. How did the 90-110 value come into that? Was it reassessed later? No. I went down yesterday, and I pulled his sheets that the county has, went to the for the local field card here, and it's $215,000 the first year he owned it, $219,000 and $228,000. This is an average house. The first garage I built was bigger than this house. It's on 80 acres of land. The other outbuildings are over 100 years old. There's nothing there of any value. It even talks about the lean-tos and the sizes in his field card as to the size of a 12 by 16 or an average bedroom that are put onto some of the garages or the other outbuildings that are there. And I hear about over within 100% or within 90% of the value, and I just have to cringe a little bit and listen to other people's stories and go, I don't even think that's close. And I listened to them as I came down, and I thought, well, what's the suggestion? What's the solution to this? And this is where you folks come in, mm-hmm. as our esteemed legislators and folks coming up with this stuff. I guess my research, I came across this true county assessor system that has been presented in the state of Minnesota, but not mandatory. And from the looks of things, or from what I listened to in the different counties down south, or even up where I'm at, I think that would be a good thing. Also, a rotation of assessors, probably every 3 to 5 years. I'm not making any suggestions, but just throwing it out there. Probably having assessors rotated mandatorily instead of getting to know each other, so we don't have this stuff where there's $250,000 in movement in a township or even in a county. It sounds great. The assessing systems that you have down here in the metro sounds like they're a lot closer than they are in outstate. And that is the reason I'm here, is to get it a lot closer. Make it fair. Make it
make it even to everybody.
And that's what we aspire to do, Mr. Lorsing. Thank you, and you did have some suggestions or ideas, and that's what we're asking for here today.
Thank you for your time.
Representative Marquardt has a question, Mr. Larson.
Well, thank you very much. No, not thank you, Mr. Larson, for your testimony, but more maybe for staff. A few years ago, probably 3 or 4 years ago, we heard from folks on assessments, and we actually made some changes. I think there's increase in education, but there was also something on an appeals that if there was a certain number of property owners in a jurisdiction, they could make an appeal, and that would force, I think, the Department of Revenue to come in and take a look at the assessment properties. And I'm kind of maybe looking to staff on the details to that, but so there were some changes that actually put a little more power into folks who thought in an area that they were being unfairly assessed and so forth. So that might be an avenue also for some of these situations that Mr. Larson's mentioned. I have to go back and look at that. I don't know if Mr. Hines,
you
can remind. I hate to put
Mr.
you on
Chair, Mr. Marquardt, I can't remember the specifics of what we did, but we did pass some of those changes, and I'm sure Mr. Hagan could fill us in if we want to take the time.
Well, that's thank you. We don't need to.
Place for some inquiry as we go forward. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Thank you, Mr. Lorsung. We've got at least three assessors in the audience. Is there anybody who has traveled more than 25 miles to get here today that wants to speak? Okay.
I guess me.
Okay, you're in.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Dan Frentress. I live in Green Valley Township, Becker County. We came down for this, and my story starts quite a while ago, but I'm kind of an example of the intimidation factor of what our local assessor did to me and my wife. We built the house of the country after finding a piece of property, a small lake of 56 acres in Becker County. Our problems with the tax assessor started when we valued my house more than I had invested in the building and the land by about 20%. Okay, the value was about 40% more than what the banks would give me on the loan. I built a fairly large house out in a small lake out in the country in the middle of nowhere and had a hard time finding banks that would actually loan me the money to build it. Okay, I followed the process outlined by the laws, and after having the entire township board visit my partially completed house, they all agreed with the hired assessor, who told me the next step go to the county board. And they told me that the federally appraised assessor that I use always appraised too low. So I picked the person appraised too low, apparently. Next step, I took a complaint to the county board. The county assessor did lower my assessed value of my house at 10% over what I invested, which was by law he was limited to. It's a shame the system always favors the government and not favors the property owner. Within 3 years, the assessor had raised my value up to what he had had when it started. So I won my case. 3 years later, he's back right where he wanted to be. And the values was, again, it was 40% over what the banks would say. When I met with the county board, my argument with the county board was, where do I borrow money from you folks? They said, they don't do that. And I said, exactly. Then why are you ahead of the private market? I had a hard time finding a bank to do this. After 1 annual increase in the value of my property, I met with the township assessor and the county assessor in my house. They explained to me why my house was listed as a D7 category, upon which has higher rates for square footage based on the assessor's opinion of the quality of the construction. Upon using their form, they found my house was a D5, and I expected a decrease in my valuation of my property, until they returned to my house 2 days later with a new form that correctly valued my property at a D7, which is what they wanted. We kept copies of those forms. This is from 15, 20 years ago. But this is the old form. This is the new form they came back with 2 days later, which has specific things to my house, which moved me to the D7, where they wanted me to be. Okay. Upon comparing field guides with some of my neighbors on our small lake, we found that some of the longtime landlords would not be in charge of valuation for the lake frontage they owned. This story did reach the newspapers in Fargo and the Twin Cities. One of my neighbors, who was also a new builder, gave the reporter a boat ride to show him that the frontage was being taxed and not taxed. After that issue was fixed, we went out to the favorite neighbors in our neighborhood. Okay, which taught us another lesson that we have found several times. If you compare your property to a neighbor's property, the result will be an increase in the neighbor's property, not in a reduction in yours. And that's how they went. By requiring true county assessing, you would then require rotation of assessors and allowing the townships to always hire the same assessor for years and years, which encourages a more lax assessment of mistakes. True county assessing with regular rotation would discourage favoritism for friends, relatives, even for county and township officials, and would catch mistakes both made in landlord's favor and in the county's favor. For many years, I went to the equalization meeting to argue my assessment with township assessors. And it was later I found out that he was an uncle of one of the township officials who was the brother of the county assessor. This was not considered nepotism by the county because the county assessor doesn't hire and fire the township assessors. The county assessment would also help that problem. The last story is when they came to my house with comparables, My house is a 5,000 square foot house on a very small lake, 56 acres. The comparables they brought to my house were on Detroit Lake and Detroit Lakes, a 1,200 acre lake with the house 100 feet from the lake, and from Haida Land Lake, a house 100 feet from the lake, and again on a 1,200 acre lake. They called those comparables. I had no reaction. I had nothing I could argue with. I said, my comparables are what my bank assessor did. They came back and said, he always assesses too low.
Thank
I'll
you
answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Can you spell your name for us?
Sure. F-R-E-N-T-R-E-S-S. Frentress. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Frentress. Members, there's one more person who came quite a distance today. We do have some assessors here. And his name is Mr. Peterson from Cass County. Is he here?
I'm with the assessors.
Okay. Yeah. We you drove a long ways to get here, sir. We'd like to hear from you. Mr. Peterson, we have about 2 minutes.
Okay.
We're already over time.
Thank you, please. Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here.
Please introduce
yourself.
Thank you.
I'm the current county assessor for Cass County, located in Walker, Minnesota. I'm here representing MAEO. I'm the current chair of the legislative committee, and we were asked to come here today to kind of address some of the questions that this committee may have or some of those that were introduced here today. I would like to thank the Department of Revenue, first of all, for the presentation that they gave. I think they gave a good perspective in an outline of how the process works. I would like to maybe just assure this committee that the Department of Revenue does have compliance officers which deal with the individual counties and cities and jurisdictions within the state, and they do come around, do audits. So we are required to meet those guidelines and those statutory requirements that are put upon us to do our assessment work. So they do check with us on a monthly and annual basis to do any types of audits that they may have concerns or questions about. So we are meeting all those. And some of the comments that we've heard today, they're all good concerns from some of the taxpayers that have showed up here today. But one thing that maybe I just want to clarify a little bit is we keep hearing this 90 to 105% ratio, and certainly with our statistical data that we're using on these sales to determine our actual market values from year to year, we're using the median or middle ratio in there. So keep that in mind. If we have a median ratio of 100%, that means if you have a grouping of sales, you're going to have some that are going to be over that 100%. You're going to have some that are going to be under that 100%. So we're not going to hit that bullseye in a mass appraisal process. We're not going to hit that every day. Our goal is equity and to use the statistical data, get that out, to get us that equity and get us within those requirements.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Sir, if you can introduce yourself and go very quickly, because we're ready to adjourn.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. My name is Stephen Baker. I'm the Ramsey County Assessor, and I'm a past president of MAO and a member of the Legislative Committee for, I don't know, 15 years or so. You know, what I would say, it's been an interesting conversation today. I think, you know, one point that hasn't come up is we have revenue, and MAO have worked together to make some changes to the sales ratio system that make it better. So I think we have learned from some of the things that have occurred through the recession and some of the volatilities in the market, and we've revised our sales ratio system to be more reflective of some of those dynamic changes in the market, and hopefully will serve Minnesota better going forward. On the issue of foreclosures, while it's true that foreclosures are eliminated from our sales ratio study, that's different than saying that assessors don't view them as part of the market and don't consider them in our work, because we do. So while we don't use them directly as a comp, they are a market force, and they will help us judge where in that 90 to 105% range our assessment should be. And we've been in some very volatile markets, and it's created a lot of pressure on the system. What I would say is I'm pretty convinced that the pressures the shifting that we've talked about agricultural properties here today, we're just starting the period where those kinds of shifts are going to be falling on the residential properties, which have much higher parcel numbers in Minnesota. So we're in a dynamic period.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Thank you, members. Thank you all who have testified. I apologize for those of you who didn't get up. I know there were some. I would encourage you, though, we are going to be hearing some bills that, dip into this assessing area. So those of you that are here that would still like to talk, those might be some good chances to address the committee. Thank you, everybody, members. Meeting is adjourned.